Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first discussion of the book, The White Luck Warrior by R. Scott Baker. This is the second book of the Aspect Emperor series and the fifth book in the second Apocalypse series, if you're looking at them as seven books. We will be working our way through this, like with all of the others, about 100 pages every week, approximately. We are reading a different edition of the book this time, but I think the UK paperback, if that's the one we're following, to approximately a little over 100 pages. Today, we're going to be talking about chapters 1 through 3, and next week discussion will be chapters 4 through 6. If you'd like to read along with us or talk about this book with us, either here in the discussion group or on the forum, consider checking out the Page Chewing forum. But with that said, with me, I have the usual group of friends. Steve, would you like to start us off with introductions?
Sure. I'm Steve from Page Chewing, and it's going to be fun discussing this one. So happy to be here.
Dan, you're next.
Oh, yeah, me. Yeah. And I'm Dan from my house, and I've read this book before many times, and I'm glad to discuss it again.
Nice.
And I'm Justin. I'm a first-time reader, and I'm suddenly worried that I'm the only one reading the Penguin Canada version.
Ooh, that looks nice.
You know, it's pretty nice.
Yeah,
it's like got a good heft to it.
Yeah, but, it looks solid. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I think we'll probably divide it into approximately six parts. I'm thinking six, but can also do five if the rest of the group thinks so. But anyway, 1/6 of whatever edition you're reading each week. Cool. So did anyone have noticed anything interesting in the what has come before bit? I know we were talking about how that has some hidden information sometimes. Sorry, go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, did the first bit just, I didn't check this, but does it just a repeat of what was at the what has come before of the judging eye? Or did it have any changes?
It added a couple of things.
I see. Okay.
Little bits and pieces.
Yeah.
As you go through the series, there's always little sneaky additions.
Yeah.
The interesting thing that... Well, it's been mentioned a couple of other times, is when, because they say when Kellos meets Moengus. Oh, hi, Carl.
Hey, Carl.
We were discussing if there's anything interesting in the what comes before of the book.
And I wasn't blown away by it in terms of, like, I wasn't shocked by anything in it, but
no.
I don't know if I missed something that was subtle.
I think it's because we've been reading through the appendices, so a lot of the stuff that's in the appendices but not in the actual content would be sort of mentioned there. But one thing I was interested again was the fact that he mentions when Kellos meets Moengus, it says, oh, like, Moengus didn't prepare for Kellos to go mad. It's like, it's right. Put like so matter-of-factly that he's crazy, right? That it's not like seeing a revelation or anything. So I'm wondering if it means anything.
Judging I was the same way.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, who is writing these? What came before?
I,
not a
yeah,
Kamian, is it? In this case, it doesn't feel like it should be. I don't know.
Definitely not a Kamian.
Yeah. The appendices, we sort of conjectured that it might be a Kamian, but it was unclear whether it was by a Kamian or just information as a Kamian would have access to. One thing, yeah, I'm very curious about whose opinions or ideas these appendices are supposed to present, because there's this line that I highlighted, and the lust for knowledge has ever been a cancer in the hearts of men. Is that the author's opinion? Is that something that is considered a bad thing in this world? Or yeah, that is an interesting statement, and I'd
that feels to me like an Achaemenid quote, even though he's certainly someone who seeks knowledge. It almost feels like something he would also say too.
Or simply from Agensis or something, right?
I do feel like Agensis is pro knowledge, but
maybe
something he would say too. Yeah,
he's pro knowledge, but also realistic of the world and how it is, I guess. I don't know.
That was an interesting thing from the appendix that, like, we didn't talk about him very much, but Agensis was like, he seemed to, be much more philosophically ahead of his time, I guess you could say. He definitely seemed, you know, to be evoking a lot of, I mean, ideas I definitely associate with, like, the Enlightenment or things like that. I mean, I know you can go back to, like, antiquity, and some people were, you know, talking in really broad, but complex philosophical ideas that we still use today. But, you know, I still think that a lot of it was it's just not necessarily where we are today or where we were even a few hundred years ago. But Agensis was really like, you know, he was on it. He was really like, you know, tackling kind of human nature and morality in interesting ways.
But there's also a mention, I think, in his part in the epilogue or something, about some of his metaphysics, which I was like surprised that he knew that. I'm not going to say what it is, but I was kind of surprised. Like, how did he manage to know that information? Because it's
Agensis?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Or it's somewhere. It's somewhere. Maybe it's not in his part of appendices, but it's something that's been attributed. Or maybe Achaemenid says, oh, Jason says about this thing, about reality. And I was like, that's interesting, because I'm wondering, like, a philosopher, how would a philosopher know? He wasn't a wizard, was he? He was just a normal philosopher.
Right, just a philosopher.
I don't know. Seems very smart, let's say.
Hmm.
It does, it does make you wonder. I mean, I don't know, obviously, what specifically you're referring to.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a, you know, a spoiler for later books or something like that. But it would be interesting if he is, you know, there's more to his story, I guess, that we, you know, maybe we'll never find out. Maybe it's just like implications, you know, in the background of, like, you know, there's more going on than him just being a philosopher, that he had some sort of connection to, I guess you could say, the outside.
Yeah, because I've seen some people mention things in discussions about, oh, what does that mean? Or why did that happen? You know, in the forums, stuff like that, like quite in-depth discussion, like talking about that same point. Mm-hmm. And which is not described, I think, anywhere in the book, like explicitly, apart from what he says. So I don't know. I just thought it was interesting.
At some point
we'll discuss it when we discuss the theories, I guess, of certain things.
You're gonna have to remember to bring that up when we finish the series.
it's a very, how to say, it's a quite fundamental metaphysical point of the world. Okay. So I think we'll get back to it, I guess.
Makes sense. This other thing also that I underlined here, I don't know if this was in the one for the judging eye, but it says, the first men could discern the joints of existence founded, the men who could discern the joints of existence founded the first sorcerer schools, which I think builds on top of all the other things we know about sorcery. And this feels like it's sort of confirming the hypothesis that sorcery is a rewriting of reality in some sense. And that's, well, it's unclear whether that's what the mark is, but that was just interesting from a metaphysical, is that the right word? Metaphysical point of view.
Yeah. And who knows why certain people can do that and others can't.
Yeah.
Doesn't the school that became the consult seem a little bit more sympathetic, because they did discover that magic users don't have to be damned, and they found a way around that? They seem a little, I mean, I know this is a stretch from what we know. I mean, I'm not, just, But just if you read what came before, if you just went into the series, just reading the what has come before, they do seem a little like they were trying to do the right thing. If you didn't know the other stuff.
But I don't know if I agree with that, though, because, I mean, I feel like the, like, you know, it was determined that, you know, sorcerers are damned. And I feel like what was discovered is that if they are able to close the world from the outside by killing everybody, then they don't have to be damned. Right. So, like, is that the secret that they discovered, that they don't have to be damned? I mean, that's how I read that.
Maybe closing the outside is a good thing.
Maybe, yeah. But maybe murdering, you know, millions of people is a good thing, too. I, you know, I'm
not enough. Listen, Just, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, okay?
You know, just like a few million or a billion eggs.
We just keep coming back to that trolley problem.
Yeah. But I mean, why are you saying it's that it's good, that sorcerers should not be damned? Why is that the right thing?
I guess they could be used for good, right? I mean, if someone is if someone is a magic user, why do they have to be damned?
Well, I mean, what is good in this world, right? If a universe was created by God and modifying the fundamental structure of a universe is, you know, that would, I could see that as being a sin, like strictly a sin, and right, and being bad.
I mean, they could help against the Inkarai.
I guess.
Against the Ark. I guess the other thing that stuck out, speaking of the Ark, that crash seemed a lot more violent and epic than it did before. Because it talks about, you know, the impact and the damage it did out of falling from the sky.
Yeah. The creation of the Ring Mountains. All that.
So one of the questions I had was why... And I've had this for a while. I just now keep forgetting to bring it up for discussion. But why is the first ordeal considered a holy war? And for that matter, the current great ordeal also, it's considered a holy war of sorts. But let's say that one's because a god is at the head of it. Why was the first ordeal considered a holy war?
I mean, it's not named as the first holy war. I guess it you know, if you're fighting for literal, like, you know, if we're taking, I mean, it's not even taking for granted at this point, because we know stuff like, you know, they're trying to seal off the outside, right? So they're essentially trying to seal off heaven and hell, it seems like. And so in that, like, case, it's literally this metaphysical battle on the physical realm. You know, based around, you know, kind of like what Dan was talking about, like if there are these just like intrinsic morals to the universe, as horrible as they may be to our perspective, you know, then it's like kind of inherently a holy war, and the consult is like inherently diabolic.
Makes sense. Yeah, I didn't think of the closing off of the outside thing, because like this is referred to as, what is it, the non-man called on his tributaries and allies to join him in a holy war against Min Oroikus. Anyway, yeah, I was thinking, what religion or holiness are you preserving with said holy war? But that makes sense.
Well, no, you raise an interesting point there too, that like, so far as we understand, the non-men worship darkness and ignorance, and like, they don't worship the gods or a god, you know, not as we have been led to view them. And certainly I think not as humans typically view them. And so did they view it? Are we supposed to read that as like the non-men viewed it as a holy war, or this is written from the perspective of humans and it's just recounting the fact that the non-men fought this war that was essentially the first holy war in a sense, because it doesn't really seem like it lines up with their sense of religion, but I don't know. I guess it's still a little unclear, especially because, you know, our primary expositor, you know, our primary POV for the non-men beliefs and everything is super crazy, you know, and really they all are. So it's like, you know, they're all like unreliable narrators to the nth degree. So it's hard to know for certain exactly what, you know, what that means.
Yeah.
Although I guess it was Achaemenid who told us about, wait, was it? No, it was Cleric who talked about the darkness and ignorance, right? Yeah. Was that Achaemenid?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Achaemenid.
It was Achaemenid? Okay.
Right?
Well, even then he's
maybe
flawed,
not,
right?
Because maybe all of them.
I don't know.
He's talking, anytime he is talking about the non-men, he's obviously talking from the perspective of someone who studied them or potentially known them, as Seswatha or whoever, you know? So I flawed POVs all around, I guess you could say.
Maybe holy was just sort of like an exaggerated adjective to describe it. It mean more to me like a just war, a good versus evil war sort of thing.
That makes sense. But also in using holy as an exaggeration, everything associated with Kellis is apparently holy. I don't know. There were like three or four different things I noted, which were very simplistic, but they had the prefix holy attached to them, both in the judging eye and in this section. It's almost funny how they do that.
That propaganda is strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was just holy horse or something. I don't know.
Holy horse, really? I don't remember that one. Maybe.
I mean, sure, the horse he rides must be holy, right?
Is he on a horse? I thought he flew everywhere or something.
Does he even in the Great Ordeal?
I thought he was like sort of like sitting cross-legged like a Buddha or something, floating around. That's how I imagined him. You know,
that's actually an even funnier picture.
He's described a bit like that at some point, right? When he appears in the umbilical or something like that, like with his hands like this and just in a flash of brightness or something.
Yeah, he's floating around.
Yeah.
For sure.
But that's when he's sitting, right? Like, is that how he gets around? Like, is that when the Holy War is marching? Kellis is just gently floating. I like that picture. I'm gonna assume that that's true. Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that. We see. Okay, is it in this part? Because I read one chapter extra. So stop me if I'm seeing something that hasn't happened yet.
Hmm.
If we get Proyas talking to Kellis.
Yes.
Okay. Good. So we do. Yeah.
And some interesting interpretations there.
Yeah, we see him in his tent, I guess. He's not floating then. He's acting normal, right?
I thought so, yeah.
That was an interesting chapter, though, was it?
Oh, it was. It was, it was interesting. Also, like, he wasn't floating, but to Proyas, it seemed like no one was there, and then he just showed up. So, did he teleport there? Like he does, or yeah, it felt like he revealed himself out of the darkness.
Yeah.
Do you now understand that you'll never understand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he says that, doesn't he? Yeah.
He really knows how to play everyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, even the reader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's fun to get more of Proyas, though, isn't it? He's very interesting character.
He's back.
Yeah.
Still conflicted.
He's sadder than ever.
Yeah.
I love it.
I was almost disappointed. I mean, it was really cool. I loved that reveal, but I was disappointed that it was so boring that when Sorvil looks at the fire and sees something staring back at him, and it turns out to be Proyas just eavesdropping on their conversation. Well, actually Kellis, but I think it was Proyas who was literally staring back at him that time. That was funny, but it was very, very interesting. So it was interesting both because one, Kellis, you find out that Kellis knows everything about what's going on with Sorvil, probably. And I have a theory that one of the reasons why he declared him the Believer King is to exactly create the schism in his friendship with, what's his name? Soranga. And the other reason is, like, you don't think of Kellis, it's hard to think of Kellis as this, like, common eavesdropper, you know, like, he's just listening in on people's conversations. That's a really difficult way to picture him, but it worked. It worked nevertheless. So that was interesting.
I agree with you that I think he named Shorewheel as a Believer King, you know, to create a schism. And I think also in a way as sort of like, not only through the schism, but like through his own sort of social pressure, like push him to actually become that, you know, like we'll see if it works, but I definitely get the sense that like, he's almost like gaslighting Swordwheel into believing he is this, you know, divine entity. There's like, yeah, you believe that, right? And sort of like, I don't know what. And he's like, no, you believe it. Like, I can see it in your eyes. I can read people. You believe it. And sort of like, wait, do I believe it? You know? And so I think that may be part of it too. Like, he's just, you know, he's Kellis, master manipulator.
But is the blessing that Sorwheel received, is that sort of insulating him from Kellis's influence a little bit? And that's like, is he able to even like have that inner dialogue instead of just being straight converted like most people are by Kellis, you know? Like I'm curious about that, like what's going on with the blessing that he received from
You don't think Kellis would see that and manipulate him?
Well, I don't know, because like maybe, you know, Kellis is like, now it's like you're rocking with like the gods, so it's perhaps there's like, this is maybe beyond Kellis, like maybe this thing, or beyond his
influence. I was gonna say, is that even something Kellis can see? Like, he could theoretically, like, unless his ability to read people is so great, like physically in the Dunyane of it all, that somehow, which just to me is comical. Like, I can't imagine how he would be able to see a blessing that he, like, I can't wrap my head around that. I feel like it would have to be almost magical if he can. I don't know that we've had any implication that he
does know magic.
Right? Like, we don't even know the nature of it fully, right? Other than that there's some sort of Yatwirian and blessing going on, and it probably is real and not just, you know, superstition.
Yeah, it's definitely not your garden variety sorcery. This is like this is something else, I feel like. So maybe it's not something Kellis has encountered. Yeah, so.
That is the interesting X factor here, right, that I totally did not expect coming into the series, and I'm really enjoying, is that there is this whole other force now that are, like, in a sense, inarguably beyond Kellis, that he's having to contend with. But they can't interfere directly, it seems like, you know, the gods, for whatever reason. You know, they have to act through people, but they can like bless them and curse them. And I don't know. It's, you know, it's something I don't think Kellis is prepared for in the same way that when he left, Itrithal, what's the name of the city? Ishual. Thank you. I don't know why that I forgot the name. Atrithal is a different place. Yes, Ishual, that, you know, he didn't know magic existed. He thought it was all a myth. And so now it's like, I mean, he believes in the gods now, but he's not, I don't know that he's aware that they're like, the way that they're combating him.
I mean, he didn't know magic, and then he sort of conquered magic. Like, he didn't know about the gods, and now he knows about gods. Maybe he, who knows?
Yeah, well, it's definitely true. Like, I wouldn't put it beyond him to have, you know, contingencies in place and to be actively trying to maneuver against them and around them. But it also makes you wonder, right? Because he believes that he is genuinely like the son of God, and that God is like the gods. So how does that work if they are working against him, like in his brain? what is, I guess that is in a sense a sort of madness, right? That he is like convinced of, you know, it's sort of the circular logic that doesn't really make sense. It is contradictory.
There's some sense.
There were rumors that he's been to hell, right? Sorry, Dan, were you going to say something?
Nothing. Go ahead.
Yeah, there were rumors in the last book that he's been to hell, right? I don't know, is there a heaven equivalent that he could have visited to, or did the visit to hell give him some information that would help him discern the motives of gods and act against them?
We did hear, this doesn't answer your question, Varsha, not really, but we did hear finally for the first time that there are apparently 100 heavens and 1,000 hells. Unless that's just like a saying, but like for the first time we were given some sort of like number, knowledge, you know, like some grounding for their beliefs. And given that a number of the beliefs seem to be concretely real, not least damnation, you know, at this point, I'm just taking things at face value, not what the character's necessarily motivations, but like the beliefs, I'm increasingly like, maybe this is all just real, you know, which I was completely opposite that. I went in very much modern minded, like skeptical of like all of the gods and stuff. And now I'm like, shit, Yotwer's like up to something, like, you know, damn, yeah. Wizards are damned. Like, I guess, or sorcerers, you know, I guess all this is real.
But yeah. If I didn't catch the 1,000 hells thing at all, but if that's true, the Kosoter, the captain of the Skin Eaters, he says, I would know if this was hell, because leading us to believe that he's been there. He doesn't say so explicitly. So I don't know, does he not believe in the 1,000 hells thing, or do they all look the same?
Maybe he went to one of them.
Right.
Yeah. No, but then how, if he believes that there are thousands of them, how would he be so sure that he would recognize it? Anyway, sorry, I think Justin, I interrupted you earlier. But...
Oh, I think I was just going to say that, you know, since we're not getting the Kellis POV in this series, like we're forced to make certain assumptions about him. I think last, or maybe during the last discussion where I wasn't at, somebody mentioned like, is Kellis, like, has he just gone ahead and mastered the other schools forms of anagogic sorcery? And that made me wonder, like, is he practicing demotic sorcery, the stuff that the Scarlet Spires guy was doing? And like, is that how he came by those, you know, nifty demon heads that he dangles from his girdle? Yeah,
that would make sense. That's a good point.
I can't imagine him not doing that, right? Like, what reason would there be?
Yeah,
I don't know.
He's like,
unless it's impossible, but.
Aren't we given to understand that the Gnostic school is a superset of all the other schools, that anything you can do with the others, you can do with this?
It's like pure. It's like at least how Achaemenid thought of it in the first trilogy was like, it gets down to like the fundamental, you know, truth of things in a way that the others, you know, schools use analogies, right? They're not speaking of the thing.
Yeah.
They're like analogizing about it, right?
That's why they have to make dragons and stuff. And Achaemenid seems like raising, you know, weird
shapes.
patterns.
But I think the demon summoning is like a separate branch, just like the magic nullifying branch and the other things. I think it's just a very different one.
That makes sense. And that would explain, right, where he got the demon heads, you know, as opposed to literally going to hell. But I mean, at the same time, right, like there are so many ways now that we know that he could have sort of done something kind of like that without literally doing the like Orpheus and like walking into the underworld sort of situation, right, where like we've seen now the white in the mountain, right, the white king, that you can like, as we learned at the start of this book, you like things from the outside can bring a part of it with them when they come in. And so, you know, if he had some sort of encounter with like a demon or another white or something that like brought hell kind of with them, you know, he would in a sense have been there. I mean, cause like, I don't think it would be completely inaccurate to say that like the skin eaters, went to hell sort of, or were like in hell, even if like they were kind of on the borderline. Right.
Yeah. There was like a lake of fire and everything. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I have to say, very quickly, I'm not going to take too much time about this. I just finished Blood Meridian last night. And first of all, anyone listening who hasn't read it, you should read it. One, because it's really good. But two, if you're reading along or a fan of these books, I suddenly see the influence all over the place, particularly with this series so far. The Skin Eaters, like, it's literally, he just like pulled kind of the main plot line and like combined it with Fellowship from Lord of the Rings. And like, it's, you know, which is all sort of playing in the same mythical pond of like the archetype of like group of heroes going on a long quest. But it's like the captain to me reads as like his take kind of on Glanton. And, you know, Cleric has some parallels with the Judge. Like, they're both these like pale white creepy dudes who say really, you know, things no one understands essentially. And clearly has a lot of secrets and a lot of mystery. And you're like, what's going on with this person? And even the name Cleric and Judge, right? Like there's, I think these are intentional parallels he's drawing. And it's very, he's doing his own thing. You know, it's not to say he's like copying or anything, like very much, you know, it's just another, in the same way that I felt like in the first series, I really saw a lot of the Dune influence. I'm really seeing Blood Meridian here. Mm-hmm. And really, it's giving me an added appreciation because I do think it deepens the story when it like, it gives you, I guess, kind of a vocabulary, you know, to talk about what he's going for.
Nice.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I see the parallels. I've read Blood Meridian a handful of times over the years, and like I see it all over this book, especially with the Skin Eaters. It's just like, it's so thrilling. And I think especially this isn't a Blood Meridian discussion, but like the last line of like the last paragraph of Blood Meridian is you know, it's like very cryptic, and there's like this
hint. Well, don't spoil it for me. I haven't read it yet.
Okay, I won't say it. But like, you know, it's very safe to say, like, you know, McCarthy's dealing with some like very like thematically super just jet black, dark human nature type shit. And it's like the last line, like, I don't know, you could interpret it so many different ways. But one of them is like, you know, that there's that essentially hell is real in some sense. Right. So anyway, no spoilers.
Yeah. Dan, you should definitely read it. As a huge fan of the Second Apocalypse, I think it would, add to your enjoyment even more.
I probably will soon. Do we want to talk about the Skin Eaters, Ben, since we're on the topic?
That's a good transition.
Yeah.
Also, I did not get to the last 10 pages. I was actively reading this. That's why I was late. And I was just like, screw it. I'm just going to hop on. Like, my brain is mush. I got this book literally on like Sunday. Yeah. So I was kind of rush reading it, and I've been just super busy and traveling. So did anything crazy happen in the last 10 pages? Can you guys just spoil it for me? Like, what happened in the last 10? I got to where they showed up at the fortress or whatever. And then I was like, all right, I need to get on this, you know.
You spoiled.
So, literally, just like I don't care. Like, we're talking about it, you know. We should talk about it. So I just want to know.
Can I do it?
Go for it.
So this is like, I feel like I didn't. I was completely. I'm always fucking surprised. Like, he always gets me every time. And like, and then I'm like, and then I look back and I'm like, it was right there, you know. But anyway, Soma of the Skin Eaters is a fucking skin spy.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And Mimara recognizes him. because of some, like, she sees him in battle essentially saving her life, defending her, and she's just like, that isn't any human shit, you know, like that's, and then she goes back to, you know, goes into how she was trained and, you know, when she was in moment to recognize it. So yeah. And then Achaemenid immediately tries to fucking blow him up with sorceries, and he like does a, you know, super flip jump, like, and like runs off into the wilderness, and like, and the skin eaters are all just kind of like, well, what the fuck was that? You know?
Fair reaction. They just it was funny because I think one of the skin eaters assumes that Soma was run out of the building because Achaemenid is annoyed that he was courting his daughter.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
But so since when do you think he's been a skin spy, or has he always been a skin spy?
That's the question. Yeah.
And why did he protect Mimara by revealing himself?
I mean, I feel like the only time they have an encounter with the Srong that I read in this book, but I feel like it would make more sense for it to have happened in Sil-Algis just because everything was so chaotic. So if he wasn't always a skin spy, which is possible, I guess, I don't know. I would have to reread very carefully. Sil-Algis seems like the obvious answer.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That, how did the council get into Sil-Algis? Well, I guess they have Srong there, but it's very, like, how did they know? I don't know.
Well, that's true. That's a good
interesting
point.
But, you know, if he was there, what does that mean? Maybe nothing, but.
Yeah, I'm so curious to possibly reread to see if he's dropping hints, because in like the preceding like 10, 15 pages, he does write something about how Soma appears not to be fatigued when everybody else is just a wreck. And one hint that he dropped. But yeah, I wonder how far back those hints go.
It would be interesting if it happened when Soma ran away.
Mm.
You know? If like almost this like moral, you know, poetic like retribution that he abandoned Mimara. I don't know. Pure speculation, but you know, I think he sort of disappeared at that point. So
certainly it was chaos and dark and nobody knew where anyone was. Yeah. That's a perfect opportunity for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense because so two things. The other thing that I thought was important about that reveal is that Mimara tells Achaemenid that he revealed himself to protect me, which, maybe he decided that now is a good time, not Kilauges, if he was a skin spy at the time and he ran away. But I feel like maybe he could have protected her without revealing himself if he was consult at Kilauges. So the fact that he ran away, I think it makes sense what you said, Carl, that Kilauges might be where the change happened. But
that's a great point. Yeah.
But to your point, Dan, about what are they even doing there? I don't know. Are they just generally chilling? Because apparently there were dragons. The Bashrag are there. So why not consult? Or are they more recently created?
I thought that a lot of these skin spies seems very purposeful. Like they put them as, like, again, spies in position of power or a crucial, you know, people to manipulate things.
That's definitely true.
Yeah, they seem like more of a scarce resource, you know.
Or do you think, that maybe one of the other companies that died in Kilauges had a skin spy? Why would they want to be with the people who hunt their own, I don't know, comrades, like whatever, like people, their side, people on their side? Why would they join those companies?
Maybe there was one in the Stone Hags, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Because the Stone Hags were hunting the other companies. That's the only thing I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
That would make sense, too. definitely having, you know, because they could work to influence the stone hacks, right? Like they could almost, because that's part of what they do beyond just spying, is they like kind of help maneuver the politics, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that would make sense, right? Because the stone hacks are definitely a force for murder and chaos, you know? the big question, the most interesting part of that to me is, why protect Mamara? Like, why go out of your way to protect her to the extent that you even risk your mission? To what end?
Maybe that's a mission. To protect Mamara or protect the Kamian.
Exactly. Like, what? Why would they be interested in Mamara in that regard? I mean, if anything, I would be like, if they want to kill her, I'd be like, yeah, of course. Like, that makes sense. Mm. You know, Empress's daughter, she's been trained, you know, she's a witch. Like, yeah, take her off the board. But to protect her, like, do they know she has the judging eye? Like, yeah.
Do you think it's got something to do with that, do you think?
Or
something to do with Achaemenid and them going to Ishwal, maybe? Or, yeah.
Yeah, or if they, you know through their, you know, skin spy network that she's not, that, you know, that she's freaked out by Kellis, or she's sort of against Kellis. Like, she's a potential threat to the Holy War. Or the.
That's a good point.
But right. How would she be a threat? Like, the only thing she has is, like, the judging eye, right?
Well, she's...
Yeah, which if they knew.
Yeah. I mean,
her and Achaemenid pose probably the greatest threat outside of the consult to...
I do think protecting them actually probably does further the consult's goals, because Achaemenid is intentionally trying to find a way to destroy Kellis. You know, but through understanding him, to find a way to break him. And so in that sense, it makes sense. I don't know. I mean, to protect Mamara specifically, I almost feel like it has to be, I mean, either like to turn her against Kellis, use her as a weapon, which is definitely possible, right? She's a personality. She has all this trauma around her mom, although she worships Kellis. So that's, you know, that's the tricky part there. But the judging eye is apparently extremely rare, to the extent that the Kamian only knows like folk tales about it, which we learn more about, right? The unborn, right? And that, which was freaky. But that, you know, potentially that could be really powerful in some, I mean, we've seen it is like, that has to be connected to how she banished the Wraith in the Mountain, right?
100%.
Because
what
Tears of God, like those don't just do that naturally. You know, she did something.
Yeah.
Well, she sees, she definitely like sees something, to where she, at one point, Achaemenid refers to it as a Kore, and she like refers to it very intentionally as a tear of God. Like, she sees some sort of essential truth or power in it that she was able to access through the judging eye, presumably. Yeah.
Yeah. Achaemenid points out that the captain also has a Korai, and he was not able to banish the non-man king. So, bit of a theory, building on what you guys said. If the swap happened in Kilaujas, maybe Soma's skin spy started out not caring about Mamara, but then saw what she did with the non-man king, and decided that she's important. And she needs to not die. But that leads to the question of, do we know how much these creatures can think for themselves? I think a fair amount, right? Do they make decisions, or do they do what they've been told?
They have souls. They can have souls, at least.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of those, it's like barely even touched on, but like one of those you're like, whoa, reveals in the first trilogy. So to my mind, that means that they have some semblance of, I mean, I guess we could debate what free will even is, right? This series wants us to ask that question, but I think they can make decisions for themselves to some degree.
Okay, so that seems reasonable if they, like, for, so all of the other theories about a commune, about Ishwal, etc., it requires that they know what a commune is up to, which is possible because a commune apparently can't tell them apart yet, right? Maybe he would have figured out the same way as Memara if Soma had stood in front of him and leaped around like he did. But I don't know, one of his servants at the palace, the people he had at his place of residence, those are a possibility. They could have figured out what he's up to and they want to tag along with him. But why protect Mimara for all that?
That's an interesting idea, is that they've been with Achaemenid all this time.
True. Maybe.
Yeah, at that point, they would have any, basically any opportunity to jump into.
I mean, they did know that he was against Kellos because he's been publishing his work, so.
Right. Yeah.
No secret.
He's not been overly subtle about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think it means when he, when Achaemenid talks about the judging eye? He says the judging eye is like seeing from the viewpoint of God. And it's like the, what does he say? He says like it's the vision of the unborn. Why would the unborn be the point of view of the gods?
So the way I interpreted that is that there are all these souls waiting to be born and they're hanging out with God. And so there may be a soul or many souls designated to be born to a particular person, and they are like with God, so they are seeing with the eye of God. That's how I read it, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Didn't think about that.
One of the things that occurred to me was just the idea of like, you know, there's this almost this like inherent innocence to the idea of, you know, because this is like going off of sort of like a very, you know, spiritual idea that like, you know, the spirit is inherent immediately, I guess, at like, I mean, even preconception seemingly, as kind of Arsha was talking about. And then at conception, right? And if the morals are based off of this kind of like inherent religious beliefs, then like, you know, they're sort of innocence. And so maybe in that sense, it's like, you know, they haven't been born yet, so they can't sin. So there can't be like, you know, that gives them some elevation.
I would think in this world though, like that, like the newborns are not innocent. Like, well, they are innocent, but it's not what the gods are looking for, I guess, right? Like, it seems to me like you need to do something to ingratiate the god to yourself and then be saved. Like, you're not saved by not doing anything, I guess, maybe. But I do remember at some point it was mentioned something about children in reference to the gods, but I can't remember what it was. I don't know if it was Yatwer or someone else, but... Yeah, I can't remember right now.
Yeah, I seem to recall that too. Women and children, there is some patron of women and children. I forget.
Yeah, Yotwer.
Yeah.
That is definitely Yotwer.
So it was something else about it, but I can't remember. About their salvation or absence of it or whatever. Yeah, I just can't remember right now.
So I think I was trying to logically track all the things to do with the judging eye that Achaemenid grudgingly gives up to Mimara. But so there's three important things that I noticed, like, please add to the list. But one is what we just talked about, the eye of the unborn. So it's the eye of God. Two, that women with the judging eye always give birth to dead children. And third, the way Achaemenid says it, I like, in a way, your life has already been lived. I think that is interesting. So those three things, I'm trying to like find the logical connection between them. So the second one, for instance, does the fact that did he mean the woman with the judging eye, her life, or the life of the child whose eye she might be seeing through. Because one, they are born dead, and because they are born dead, maybe, like, you know, their place in heaven is already decided, and so they're never going to come into this world to be judged. But so that would also explain the third thing. But if not, I'm trying to make sense of how the three things fit together.
The third thing is similar to the white luck thing that we saw in the last book. A bit.
That you've already lived your life?
Sort of. As in, you know, because the white luck was just like someone sort of stepping into history. Because the gods already saw that history was happened like that. So he was just stepping into history, I guess, or into what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's the idea of determinism. Yeah. That, like, you know, it plays into, like, the idea of the visions being literally true, you know? Like, that these are things that have already happened, even though you have not personally experienced them yet. Like, that time is... It just is. It's all written.
Maybe it's limited. Maybe it's only special people that the gods can see or are predetermined, maybe? That's what it seemed to be, at least from talking about the white luck and... the judging eye, I guess? I don't know.
That's interesting that they write the stories of some people ahead of time, or that they just are and not everyone. I guess I'd taken it for granted that, like, it's just like this is a universal constant, but if it's the gods influencing it and deciding it, then yeah, it could just be specific individuals.
Because why would he mention it otherwise? Why would he specifically mention it, Akimian, right?
Well, I think it could still just philosophically be the idea that, like, your life is, like, the future, you may not have experienced it yet, but it exists. Mm-hmm. Like, it already exists. And so regardless of who you are, like, just through the judging eye or through the God's POV, right, you are just seeing what has happened and what will happen, what it's like foundationally.
So maybe he knows that's why she knows that things are damned or not, because she sees them when they will die, you know, it already is happened. So
yeah, like one of the things that she does, I thought one of the cool sections was after Sutadra dies, and she sort of experiences, she has this judging eye moment where she witnesses and understands the way, like, the circumstances of his life essentially coerced him into being a skin eater and, you know, coerced him into damning himself. Like, you know, he was, in a sense, he was always damned, you know, he had he had no good choices in so many situations that, you know, and that's sort of a backward view of it's looking back on, like, determinism, like, you know,
right,
the circumstances in which he found himself in. And that's, you know, that's, like, as far as I know, that's the first time she had that kind of experience. So, like, presumably there will be more, and maybe she'll start seeing in all directions. She'll be judging everyone in four dimensions before we know it.
Yeah. Have we seen anyone that's not damned for now? Or is everyone damned?
Mara, maybe not.
Do we know anything?
I mean, I feel like there has to be people who aren't damned. Otherwise, like, what's the point? I mean, unless the gods truly don't care, but it kind of seems like you can win their favor. So that if you just play by their rules, you can go to some type of heaven. I don't know if that heaven is nice. You know, but like, I don't know. I feel like there has to be some way, like, otherwise, like, what's the, like, do people, it's not a crime then. Like, at that point, it's not a crime to do sorcery or, like, whatever. Cause if you're just damned, you can do whatever. Like, it doesn't matter, you know, at that point, unless the other option is just, like, oblivion. Mm-hmm. But that isn't, like, in the conversation. It doesn't seem to be, at least.
Maybe they're already in hell.
Shit.
Yeah.
Oh, Steve, bringing back the theories from Manifest Delusion.
I don't know. It's a good podcast, but it's, I don't know. Again, but it, I'm not sure. You could argue in different ways because it just depends where, what your definition of morality and the right thing is. Possibly, I think you could say, for example, that everyone is damned because everyone is, I don't know, because the gods judge everyone to be damned. And then by that definition, then there's...
Right, I mean, they could.
It's not a paradox. It's just, it sucks, but it's a paradox, I guess.
Right, that's just like, at that point, it's just, it's almost...
It's meaningless, but...
Yeah. Yeah, but I just feel like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we'll find, you guys have read the books. I don't know. We'll find out. But I feel like the gods judge some people as being okay to go to some form of heaven. That's just my reading of it so far. And I get the sense, like, for example, the Yatwirian priestess, whose name I'm blanking on, I feel like even though she's like also seems horrible in her own way, like, I feel like she's probably going to one of the heavens.
Probably.
Just because she plays by the gods' rules, you know? I mean, that's what really what it comes down to, it seems like.
Are the gods just powerful demons?
Well, I guess that also begs the question, do they decide who goes, right? Because theoretically, I guess someone could be damned and they're, you know, it's not the gods deciding. The gods are just like... these beings from the outside that can influence things, but they're not like who, they don't have the power to decide who goes to. And we talked about that with like, I think we talked about that maybe in the last episode with like the idea of like the Greek underworld and that, like, you know, it's not always like, there is still this sense of like morality that determines where you go in the afterlife, but it's not like Zeus wasn't deciding, you know, this person is going to the fields of Asphodel, or, you know, it was, or even Hades, right? It rules the underworld. Like, people just went to places. And I don't know, maybe I don't know enough and someone who listens can correct me, but it does seem like there's something kind of just inherent, or there's the possibility that there's something inherent to damnation rather than the gods themselves deciding.
Yeah, that makes sense because, I mean, unless the judging eye is presenting the view of any particular god, it's not that she's saying this god is damning this person, but this other god might accept this person into their heaven. It's damnation, period. So, yeah, this generic notion of damnation makes sense. I think that's how they talk about it. They have been talking about it so far. But, yeah, the rest of it. Sorry, go ahead.
So I was gonna say, so like, are the, like, and then there's also the, you know, consider the perspective of the Fanim, who think that all of the, you know, the lesser gods are just demons, you know, in which case like, everybody's damned.
Yeah. Well, the Fanim are heretics, so we don't
not from their point of view.
Even not heretics, yeah.
I think the only people who aren't damned are just like, they're just too boring. They don't make the book.
That's a good point. I mean, she's been with the skin eaters, so it's not the right crowd to look for non-damned people.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, they're all damned. I mean, like, there's not a single one of them that,
I mean, some are seem nice for most of it, but.
Yeah, but he's literally, you don't become a skin eater by being a nice person, like a real, like a kind person, like truly, like you end up in that position, you know, not to bring you back to blood meridian either, but like you start going around scalping people, even if they're like monstrous savages, right? Like you're probably not a good person.
But see, that's part of what I think Mamara is seeing. And we sort of talked about this at the beginning of this series, like, is the world better off for Kellis's influence, right? And part of what Mamara sees when Sutadra dies is like the way that the circumstances of his life forced his hand. So like possibly like the people in Blood Meridian whom you could also make an argument for like what choices do they have, you know, starve or do horrible things. You know,
particularly the kid, right? That's sort of the inherent thing. I mean, that's why I'm not going to get into spoilers, but like you are very much meant to question. Like, I think the book literally like basically asks you right in the opening to be like, you know, consider the trauma that this child went through.
Uh-huh.
What does that make him? You know, what does that make it forgivable? You know?
Yeah.
What is it all? The question of morality and like, you know, where you come from and how, you know, the world can just, you can just be born into the shit. And, you know, what do you do about that?
Yeah. I mean, is like Blood Meridian might be like just a long form apology on a long form apology for like civilization, you know, because like, like, you know, because it prevents this type of like, you know, all really, really bad behavior. Right. But, like, yeah, the Wild West or the Wild North, as it were, under Kellis is this, you know, and that perhaps like the, you know, economic circumstances or, you know, political circumstances that all these people find themselves in, these like career soldiers, like maybe Mamara poses a threat to Kellis because she can see plainly with the judging eye that like the world is not better off for his influence. Mm-hmm. You know, begets things like the skin eaters.
Looked at Kellis with the judging eye and saw him as like
no, just her vision of Sutadra as how I was looking at it, like,
because if that's, yeah, that's, in that case, I am very excited. I just feel like she's going to look at Kellis and he's going to be like,
yeah,
just indescribably horrible.
It's going to be like literally like God. Like, I could see it both ways.
Or maybe,
to be honest,
yeah,
right? That's,
I mean, it could be depending. I don't know. I mean, he should be like damned because he's a sorcerer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, not even considering anything else he does, there's that. But I just feel like the universe will not smile upon Kellis.
Well, if they found a way for sorcerers to not be damned, I think Kellis would probably know by now how to not be damned. So if maybe he knows the loophole.
The loophole, yeah. Is there a loophole?
And is the loophole something that would be visible to the judging eye? Because, I mean, the loophole they have currently is to close off the world to the outside. But the Kellis loophole that has to be visible to the judging eye needs to be something inherent, something you change about yourself.
Yeah. I feel like if loopholes exist, like, I feel like loopholes might exist in this universe, as it seems like a lot of the stuff with the gods and damnation is not like intention, it's action, which leads to being like, if you can find a loophole to, you know, still maintain the action but change your intention, you know, that would still work.
How do you reconcile that though with like someone like a Kamian who hasn't done that many like really terrible things?
Well, but again, if changing reality the way gods do it but not being a god is sin, then he has sinned a lot. Right.
But, and what's the loop? I mean, I guess that's the question, right?
Maybe the loophole is what the Shisarim had, where they could do sorcery,
that's true.
But not.
Right, you don't see the mark on them. No, I mean, that's a good point. Yeah, they're definitely still a continuing big question mark on how that works. Mm-hmm. Why don't they have the mark? You know, are they not damned?
I just want a judging eye tool that we can like apply. Let's build an AI tool for this and just ask it, like, would the judging eye consider this damned or not? Because this is our, is the mark the entire reason that Mimara sees the sorceress as damned, or is it something else? So Sizorim, would they be visible to the judging eye as damned or not? I just want to run it through all the things.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. I kind of want to know if we'll know more about the Sizorim, but I feel like, yeah, can Steve and Dan tell me afterwards without spoiling it for the other two?
Who knows?
Nobody knows. You'll just have to read it, Varsha.
Will I find out if I read the last page of the book?
No, don't do that.
No, I'm kidding.
There's so many things to experience.
What? Yeah, and I mean, they got to be coming back because, like, yeah. The son of the Padi Raja is like cruising around in the lands, and there's he's
true. Yeah. He is fair. Yeah,
he's getting much more gold.
Yeah. I guess talking about other things we don't know is what do you think is going on with the query, I guess? Because it seems like it may be some sort of like it's the Lembas equivalent for this world, right? The elven food from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. It's more like right? elf meth.
Yeah, it's like it seems like more like a drug, right? What is he giving them?
yeah, that one is, that seems ominous to me also. Like,
yeah, it seems to be helping though. Like, they've been running like a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, at what cost? Like, what are already Achaemenid's experiencing some withdrawals where he's getting like pretty edgy when it's time for his next hit, you know? And like,
Interesting. I didn't think to read that as addiction, but that makes sense. It makes sense.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. I feel so much, you know, I feel more intrigued by the non-men now than ever, having like some of the little bits and pieces that we've gotten from Silaugis and from just from Cleric and the query, like what is that? Like I find them like the sort of the way that Baker's laying out the way that they the way the non-men see the world in a completely like literally see the world in a different way, and like they don't prescribe to this like you know sort of like scopic regime, like they don't see. They don't have paintings because like they don't see them, you know, like that's some like, you know, that's like some mind blowing shit, you know, like, so they, they start like chronicling their history with these really, really ornate sculptures and yeah, I don't know. Cleric, there's a lot there.
I was trying to imagine what there would be like, and maybe it's sort of like they see everything just black and white. They sort of see like just light and shadow. And that's why we can see sculptures and not paintings, because they're all flat. But I can't imagine how else I would justify that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. And they all like kind of have the same face, right? Like sort of the way that the Srank kind of all have the same face. Like
Achaemenid said that they can recognize each other. They only look the same to us.
Yeah,
I guess humans are racist towards non-men.
Yeah, to humans they all look the same, right? Yeah, totally.
A little detail too that freaks me out and I think is awesome is the fused teeth.
Yeah,
like it's hard for me to imagine, but like what I do imagine is just like it's spooky. Like, you know, it's like it's so close, but just like a little off, and just doesn't feel right. Like you're like I don't like it.
But flossing must be so easy for them.
Yeah, it's true. Dentistry, no problem.
Yeah, but if you ever have to get a tooth pulled, man.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah, does it all just come out?
I love the scene in which Achaemenid climbs up to the top of the forest, which we have to talk about that forest, by the way. But he goes to the top of the forest. Like, he's been fine with Cleric so far, but he freaks out and asks him, "Who the hell are you?" when he sees him behind him. He's like, "How did you get here so silently? And I didn't feel a thing." So that was funny. And but also I thought it was very interesting that when they got down, Cleric started to forget what he had seen already. I thought their gaps in memory were like he forgot what happened a long time ago. So apparently he just can't remember and keep track of much.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that. And like, that makes me wonder what the captain, you know, like if the captain is just constantly like, you know, filling in the blanks for him, you know. And
yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, did we already, I'm trying to remember, Steve, do you know if we've already found like description of the erratics and, you know, how they sort of, how we deal with the memories?
Brief.
I think it was mentioned.
Yeah. You're talking about like doing the worst shit imaginable just to feel
no,
something?
No, not really. But okay.
Okay. Well, then no.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Maybe. Okay. Maybe it's later on. But okay. Ignore me.
So, Varsha, you said the trees.
Yes.
You're talking about the mop and the trees.
That's the first time I noticed a lot of the rings battle. Yay, Varsha's bought a lot of the rings. I've been like completely clueless. I see it when you guys point it out, but I don't remember a lot of the rings at all. But, you know, sort of like not the tree-beard forest. The forest is alive and it's in a very twisted way. It's feeding off of the dead. And I guess Akamian hears the trees communicating with each other. We don't know if that's true or not, but he hears it, he senses it. And then the trees are so tall, which I seem to remember from Fangorn. Like some of the descriptions seem to match. But I loved it. I think my realization from the last few books that I've read, I love creepy forests. I really do.
I'm with you. Yeah,
and it's cool when they say like, oh, they say that there's like each tree is like a soul or something like that, and you're like, oh, you know, you just read it as a legend, and then they're like, oh no, we went and cut the tree, and there was like a body inside, right?
Yeah, that was creepy.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. I was wondering about that. I was gonna ask you guys what you thought. Like, Did it? Because there was like the implication that they almost like maybe eat the body if they're like buried with it, or like is that what was going on there? That was freaky. I don't know how you guys read that.
Yeah,
I wonder if it's some sort of like, I don't know, the trees take some of the sentience or whatever. Because this is, I assume this is another area which it's a bit thinner towards the outside, I guess, probably.
Yeah,
or maybe there's something else going on.
Are they just going to go topoi after topoi in this journey? But yeah, that was super creepy when they said that they found bodies underneath. It was unclear whether the trees
inside, right?
Inside the tree?
It was inside, right? It's within the like the core of the tree.
Yeah, they chopped down the one tree to make the stump, and that's where the like skull of a human is like embedded partially in the stump of it.
So kind of like when the skulls come out of the earth from the first trilogy, right?
Yeah.
That's a whole lot creepier than I imagined it. Sorry, Justin.
No, I think it's so cool how, again, like Baker is always doing this with like Tolkien's lore, like he's, you know, putting his own cool twist on it. And like, in that section, he talks about how the trees are like, it's something like it takes them 100 years to come to sentience, and they are like perpetually confused, and they begrudge creatures who are quicker than them, who are like, you know, who can move more quickly than them. And so like the trees are like angry and slow to move, but definitely sentient, you know, but they're not like Ents, where they're like, at least not yet, you know, they're not getting up and walking around. But it's cool how, like, you know, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, like the Ents had previously like found sentience and have been slowly falling asleep. And these are kind of doing the opposite thing. Like they're slowly coming awake and they're angry and they've all rooted in the, like, you know, these former battlefields that are just like, you know, littered with bodies and souls and blood. Yeah.
What was I going to say? I forgot. But yeah, I think this is my favorite place that we've seen so far. Killau just was, and I mean, I guess it's weird to say favorite place because all horrible things happen in all the places we've been. But Killau just descriptions were fantastic. But I think this one almost beats it out for me. I love the description of this forest and all the things that you said, Justin. Like, for that reason, it's just how creepy it was. I thought with the when they chopped up the tree that it was uprooted and they saw skulls at the bottom. But oh my god, it's if they chopped it and the stump had skulls, that is so much scarier. Yeah.
It's so awesome. Yeah, because it came in at first is like he glanced at it and he thought somebody had like carved it into the stump of the tree, and then he like looked closer and it was like an actual human skull. So awesome. I totally agree. I was so into the mob.
Yeah.
The series really is like as much horror as fantasy. I mean, I guess you can argue, like, you know, where is even the genre boundaries there, but like, you know, when you think of a lot, like I don't think it's uncommon to have some horror elements in epic fantasy, but I've never seen it like this, where it's like they feel like there's just as much like just pure horror as there is like kind of the classic grandiose epic fantasy, you know. It's awesome. I mean, it definitely gives the series its own freaky cool vibe.
Yeah, I mean, the last chapters of The Judging Eye were like, you know, like Clive Barker, like it was so wonderful. And just like, yeah, I loved it.
I have a new topic to bring up, but did we have anything more to say about the forest? So Memara does this thing when I noticed it first at the end of The Judging Eye, when she sees Cleric do his sorcery, she keeps thinking Ishroy. I think that's the word. Every few paragraphs, Ishroy. Full stop. That's the sentence. And then, like, she did that a few times. And she did that, and I thought the word Ishroy meant something to her. But she did that again in this book where they are being chased by stone hags. Paragraphs, 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 stone hags. Paragraphs, stone hags. Like, I don't know. I was curious what you guys made of that. It was interesting. Is she like being obsessive with the thought? Is she trying to make sense of it? Like, what? Why is it written like that?
I think it's more like a stylistic choice to just give more impact to that word, I guess.
Yeah, I'd agree. I also think it's for maybe just like her POV to like emphasize, as you were kind of saying, Varsha, that like she's like grappling with this, you know, she's like shocked. These are like, these are things from like almost like legend, you know? I mean, in the Ishroy case, literally, and that it's like, holy shit, like Ishroy, 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 you know, like this is real. This is happening right in front of me, you know? And her, you know, it's maybe Baker, yeah, trying to like, through the prose, evoke that idea, that feeling.
Yeah.
And the stone hags were pretty cool. I like the stone hags. They're like, so, I don't know, because there's like the skin eaters, and there was like, oh shit, there's a company even harder and stronger and more fucked up than the skin eaters. And they don't hunt the strang, they hunt other companies. Yeah. Like, can you imagine how fucked up they must be?
Yeah. And
crazy.
And in the skin eater fucked up category, we have the captain climbing a tree in the middle of the night to go kill a guy because he's weeping. Oh, yeah.
That was free. Again, another pure horror scene. Like the way that he wrote that was so freaky. And the smile. Yeah. Oh my god.
And
it was like, oh.
Isn't Akamian free sober? Like I liked how he was trying to stop himself from crying later on.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was so creepy. Just like, and then everyone the next morning not even acknowledging what happened. It's like, you know, I'm not gonna deal with this.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna keep my head down and
I didn't even realize until that scene that the captain apparently, I've given up on saying his name apparently, but I didn't even realize that he had long hair, because in the description it says like the sheets of black hair. He saw him through that. I was like, oh, he has long hair. That's cool.
Yeah, it's funny. I think in the last discussion, which I wasn't at, I think Carl, you said that Sarl was Sean Gunn in your memory, right? So
yeah, from Guardians of the Galaxy, the like captain. Yeah.
So I've been reading the Kasoder as like Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now. You
know? I see it. Yes.
So like the hair was really like that didn't fit, you know, with me, but now he's just like Colonel Kurtz with hair. So
Sarl is more like Gollum now or something. Like,
right? That's so true.
He speaks like Gollum, doesn't he?
More and more. Yeah.
He's really lost it.
Why doesn't the captain kill him? He's sobbing all the time.
Is he though? Is he?
Kind of.
I don't know that he's like crying. He's just like kind of freaking out a bit. And it's very, he seems very harsh about just the idea of tears.
Yeah.
You know, you express a tear, it's like that specifically. You know, if you like moan, he's like, fuck you, keep walking. You know, it's a slog. But if you cry, sobber time, you know?
Dude needs therapy.
Yeah. I didn't know Gunner the Guts, but yeah, this dude is bald.
Oh.
The long hair. That's going to be a switch.
I kind of imagine him as like, you know, half shaved and half like long hair sort of look.
That's
and
cool.
Like the hair is completely like he's washed it maybe 3 years ago or something.
Yeah.
You know, like oily and tangled and disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair. Do you guys have any theories on what's going on with the Non-Man and Kasoder, the captain? Yeah. Is it just second apocalypse 51st dates?
Yeah. We're watching romance in action. I can't even respond to that. It's just the best.
That was my literal theory. You just gave it a way better name.
Maybe. Oh man.
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a specific plan in mind, if that's what you're asking, or like, I mean, clearly the captain is like keeping him under his yoke, but like, I don't know if they have, like, we keep getting hints that like the captain is like maybe immortal or like older than he looks, you know, and that like there's something magical going on with him. You know, he talks again about like he went to hell and came back, and I kind of feel like he's maybe not lying about that, you know. Like, I don't know, he's so scary that like I just kind of believe anything he says, you know.
Yeah.
Like he could tell me he's one of the gods, I'd be like, yep, that's Gilgale right there, like that's the fucking guy. I don't even know, man.
Yeah, I was really immersed in that version of the world where he's an immortal of some sort, but then he reminded us that he's a veteran of the First Holy War, which doesn't necessarily negate that theory, but then also just he's older for having lived through the First Holy War, it seems like. So yeah, I'm very curious about that. I think that's one of the big mysteries for me, this guy.
I'm curious if it's going to stay ambiguous, because I don't think this is the judge is ambiguous in Blood Meridian. That's like one of the big things, like, is he human? Is he not human? He's based on a real human person in history, but it's like, what's his deal? You know, and there's a lot of like, it could go either way. It's left very ambiguous. And I'm wondering if we're going to get a similar situation here where we're like, we don't know, you know, there are all these hens, but like, maybe he's just full of shit, you know?
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I will say, I actually also feel like, I don't know if this is intentional or not, or if this is just like drawing from similar inspirations, but like, I'm also getting kind of big Euron Greyjoy vibes, not from the TV show, but from the book series, A Song of Ice and Fire, where they're both like, there's this allusion to being like, having done just like crazy dark magical things. Mm. And it's unclear if they actually have or not. And I don't know if anyone has read the Winds of Winter chapter that was released called The Forsaken, but it goes into Euron Greyjoy more. And it's like, I don't know. It's just the idea of this like creepy bearded, he has a beard too, right? Like, I'm not making that up.
Yeah, I think yes.
He has like long black hair and a beard. Anyway, I don't know. He's scary. I don't know, man. I don't know what's going on with him. And I'm curious if it'll be left ambiguous or if there's like a secret. Like with the cleric, we're going to find out. I wasn't sure if we were going to find out. And then the fact that we keep like, Achaemenion again asked him, who are you? Like, there's something there. Like, we're going to find out.
So about that, Achaemenion thinks to himself, when he's wondering who cleric is, he wonders if he's a Kuya mage.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought all Nornmen sorcerers were Kuya mages. Is that not true? Like, isn't the fact that he's a Nornman and someone who can do sorcery enough to put him in that category? Like, why do you think specifically about that?
I thought he did identify him. I don't know if it's a question. I don't know what's up there. Because yeah, I'm with you. I thought that's just the non-min sorcerers, or at least the ones that are left.
Yeah. Yeah, that confused me. Or like,
he's more thinking about like, you're not just a non-man, you're a mage non-man.
Hmm.
Is that what he's thinking?
Yeah, let me see if I can find the portion of the like what the context was, because like it felt almost like a question. Ishroy or not, that is unknown, right? Like, I forget what Ishroy are, but that's a specific category of non-men that he may or may not belong to. But I thought the fact that he can do sorcery just makes him a Kuya mage, but I'm not sure.
I think so.
This felt
because you can like be a Shroy without being a mage, right? I thought that was happening.
Say that again, sorry?
Like, the fact that he's Ishroy, he's non-man and everything, doesn't mean he's a mage. Not all non-men were mages. And not all powerful non-men were mages either, so.
Yeah,
I thought that's what he was like. Oh, you're not just an old non-man, you're a fucking, like, a fucking mage or something.
All right.
Okay,
which is even more special, I guess.
Yeah. Mm. The one I... here we go. Yeah. So, this doesn't do page numbers. What what chapter is it? Chapter 3, I guess. There is... Yeah. Okay. So, this was him wondering why a Kuya mage is keeping the company of scalpers, not...
Yeah.
Whether he's a Kuya mage or not. I think I misread that time. Okay.
But I think that part was from the previous book. When they go into Slouches and when he does his first magic and it came in, he's like, oh shit. You can do magic, right? No. From when he sees him the first time, actually, because he sees the mark in him. Yeah. And he's like, he's not just a normal non-man. He's,
He knew. So this one, So this was when he sees the... mercenary schoolman saying, like, he thinks to himself that he understands why a mercenary schoolman would keep scalper company, but why is a Kuya mage doing that?
My first thought is unless the captain has something on this guy, which I don't know, man, but he's probably like a, I mean, he's clearly a warrior of some sort. And, you know, it's not uncommon for soldiers to like, especially you look at like the Middle Ages, you know, a lot of soldiers would like, once the war was over, you know, the men at arms, they'd be like, well, what are we going to do now? I don't want to go work a farm. You know, I don't want to sit on my ass. So it's like, okay, we'll become bandits and start robbing people, or we'll become mercenaries, you know, and get someone to pay us. And so I could see him just like kind of fighting is what he knows, like kind of again, getting to Blood Meridian thematics. Like, so he just sort of feels like this is his place. Like he just like finds himself doing this again, you know. That's just my thought on it. I don't know, you know, we'll see. I guess the point I'm getting at is that he's probably a big warlord from the past, but I don't know. I don't remember any of the Nonmen names. We know a bunch of kings, but I couldn't tell you a single sin. Is there a sin something or kin something? I may be making stuff up. I don't know. I think there's a Nil.
Nil Dictus?
No, yes, that's one of them. And then there's this one that starts with C, who is like the big one. Sijar Sinmoy? Sinjar Sinmoy? That sounds almost right.
Yes.
He's like the big
one. Yeah, like the big emperor guy, but yeah.
Yeah.
And Nil Gekas is the ruler of Seleucus, right?
I thought it was the White in the Mountain who is.
Yeah, who was the ruler of Seleucus when he
was that Nil Gekas?
Oh, right, okay. I think. I've tried to.
I thought he had some other name that like we hadn't learned before we went to Seleucus, but Nil Gekas we've heard about for a while, but I don't remember. I don't want to look it up because I'm afraid I'm going to spoil something for myself, but.
Yeah, I don't dare look anything up.
The Nonmen names are it's hard to keep up with them.
Could you guys remind me what an Ishroi is?
It's the nobles.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it? Okay. The Nonmen nobility. Yeah. Okay. Fair.
Yeah.
But why did Akamian conclude that he's Ishroi?
Maybe
he said something. It might even literally be the magic. Like, I think it Kuya mages might be all Ishroi.
Was it? It wasn't when Nil Gekas recognized him. It wasn't that.
So no. I found it in the Judging Eye book. Apparently, he just concludes that because he's super old. His mark means he's old, older than you could imagine. And that means he's not only a Kuya mage, but Ishroi, a non-man noble.
Okay.
So was it maybe because the non-man nobles were the only ones who were, you know, quote, gifted with immortality?
Oh, is that... I thought all I the non-men were...
Yeah, it must be everyone, because otherwise... All of the women wouldn't have died, right?
Right.
I think.
Yeah, it was all of them.
While we're on the topic of non-men in the past, is the guy we met in the prologue, are we supposed to think that is... is his name... Is Ishtarabent the place? That's a place, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That guy. But the one who betrayed them for the consult. Are we supposed to think that's one of the consult guys is what I'm asking? I was so unclear, and I'm increasingly unclear if that guy in the prologue of the very first book is consult or not. I thought when I first read it, he wasn't, but now that I know they are consult, there are non-men consult, I'm wondering if he is, because he was around the Strong, but he killed the Strong, but the Strong almost kind of seemed wild too. So I don't know. I don't know if that's a spoiler, if that's like a thing that we
don't know yet.
Or was he just like a feral non-man? Because there's also...
That's what I was thinking when I first read it, but I kind of, I don't know. I've wondered.
Yeah. Because he definitely had a relationship with the Srank, like, and there's... But there's, in the appendices that we read, there was a term for like the Srank or the humans that non-men hang with to help them with their memories, which is another kind of like what Kasoder is doing for a little bit. And it's
Oh, so it was mentioned. That's what I was mentioning before. But it was like that the non-men have a human with them a lot of the time, erratics, that tells them their memories and
forget. That was in the appendices. But yeah, I feel like if that guy was I don't know. Maybe he could be consult, I guess. But
Where was it that we saw the non-man consult? I forget.
The first chapter of the first book of the first trilogy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Maybe. We saw a non-man.
He's the guy that Kellis runs into.
Yeah.
But Carl said we also know that non-men can be consult. Oh,
from the appendices, I think.
Oh, okay.
Right.
No, not it's not even just the appendices. It's Achaemenid dreams of it. The like famous traitor who has a swath of seas in the walls, who's like hanging. They like captured him. He's like hanging at Ishtarabinth, I think. I think that's why I associated Ishtarabinth.
I thought it was Sauglish, but yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, one of those places.
These lead together at a certain point. On the first.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I think talking about like his dreams, one thing I thought was cool, weird, was that he dreams of the library, right? Of Sauglish. And he sees like the door of the library with all the sorcerers and everything. And like he mentions like that the mages like trapped souls inside it to work. And I'm like, that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, I agree. That was. I'm glad you brought that up. That is fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, very did it like with the puppet in the first trilogy, right? But that magic is definitely evil.
Puppet assassins.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he didn't seem to have any qualm with it. He's like, oh, you know, it's just a soul. Who gives a shit?
No big deal.
The puppet that rescued him?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I need to read these dreams more carefully. I'm completely lost on what you guys are talking about.
Well, here we didn't have a puppet. He just sees the entrance and he's got like all these amazing magic souls trapped in it, right?
Yeah, it's...
Oh, wow. Okay. And did we find out about the consult non-man in the dreams in this set of chapters also?
No, I think it's the first trilogy.
That was like book two, I want to say.
Yeah, so Swat is talking to him, right?
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the walls of Sauglish because it's where they... I think so. Because that's where they hang all the people and... I think.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Saving it for a reread then.
The Sauglish is that pretty far north? Because that's where the coffers are then. Is that no? Yeah. Okay. Sauglish is where the coffers. So what about
it's on a map, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I was just looking at the map.
It's south of Golgothrath across the water, I think. A bit, yeah.
Yeah. Ishwal is around Golgotharoth, and I guess Sauglish is somewhere in the area.
There it is. Okay.
Yeah, it's on the other part of like that big like gulf. Ishwal is also on that.
Yeah, Sauglish is like southeast
in general.
Yeah.
So what about the baby? What does the baby mean in the dream?
Which baby?
Like he's holding the scroll with the location.
Oh, yeah.
Ishwal, and it turns into the corpse of.
Oh, that was freaky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he tries to like shake it. He tries to let go of it and it like is stuck to him. What is that? Like, I don't know. I was like.
His dreams increasingly. I want to know. Yeah. I don't know.
Interesting. It's in the same. It's the same chapter as him talking about the judging eye, right? I wonder if there's anything. There's any relation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was all... It was like, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it was like described like a non-man baby, right? Like it was like pale white and had like black eyes. Yeah. Am I misremembering that?
Mm. I didn't read it.
That's what I thought I remember, but I could be wrong. Maybe it was just described like a corpse. I don't know.
It did say black eyes, but I thought, I didn't think non-man at the time, but you're right, it could be.
But it's interesting that both Siswada doesn't see it. It's like, it's only Akamian. It's like, Siswada is treating it like a normal thing, and Akamian is like, oh shit, I need to get rid of it. But not the right.
Yeah. Siswada was up to some weird crap. The judging eye thing about the unborn children, that also made me think of the no god, because all babies are born still. So I wonder if that's somehow related, like what the judging eye does and what the no god does to.
That's interesting, right? All the stuff about babies and being unborn and I wonder if there are connections there, if that's just all like thematic.
Mm.
Yeah.
There was something in one of the dreams on page 23, chapter 1 on my copy, but this is what the gasps is not what happened, or he didn't get to finish what happened. So it's almost like he's talking to a Kamian who's reliving the dream, saying it's not what happened. So you have to wonder what's going on there.
Yeah. Is Seshwata talking to Akamian directly now? Yeah. That was interesting. And also the baby starts talking non-man. Sorry, no god-like. Tell me, what do you see? What am I?
That's right.
And and we're seeing the no god referred to as the whirlwind. I don't remember if the appendix had anything. I seem to recall it does, but it's being referred to as the whirlwind in this.
Mm-hmm.
Very peculiar.
Very peculiar.
Quotes? The time for quotes?
Quotes. Why are you looking at us, Steve?
There was one dreams are the darkness. Dreams are the darkness that can only be illuminated. Or dreams are the darkness that only slumber can illuminate. I think.
Nice.
That explains a lot.
Mm. Okay, Ginyursis is the king of Silagis.
Okay.
I remember, because that was a name that I feel like I didn't know before in the first trilogy. I feel like the two big names we knew were like Sujara Sinmoy, Kujara Kingmoy. I don't know if they are hard seas or not. And then Nilgikas, and then the traitor. Actually, that's the third, the traitor.
No, you're right. Nilgikas is, but it's mentioned, right? It's the one.
He's like one of the non.
No, isn't it?
Oh,
fuck. I don't want to say spoiler. I need to check. Let me check before I say anything.
I'm always afraid to say too much.
Yeah, no, because I think it's mentioned in the last book. And
you guys are looking at that. One of the epigraphs. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Mikaratrig is the traitor.
Oh, Mikaratrig.
I knew to look without spoiling something. I looked it up. Mikaratrig. Yes, that's the dude who's hung up.
Brave.
Yeah, that was a risk, but I felt like I knew how to avoid.
Hmm. One of the epigraphs in chapter 2, we belittle what we cannot bear. We make figments out of fundamentals, all in the name of preserving our own peculiar fancies. The best way to secure own's deception is to accuse others of deceit.
Mm.
I marked kind of social media in a nutshell.
I marked that quote as well. It's like, yeah.
I like this one. Few passions require quite so much certainty as spite.
Mm. I marked a quote from cleric that struck me as very Dunyane, where he says, ever are men stranded on the surface of things, and ever do they confuse what they see with the sum of what matters. Ever do they forget the rank insignificance of the visible, and when they do honor the beyond, the beneath, they render it according to what is familiar. They disfigure it for comfort's sake. You guys got bars.
Yeah. That's real good. That's it is interesting how they're like, they worship this, like, almost this, like, you know, very Lovecraftian, eldritch idea of, like, you know, the unknown and the unknowable, you know, that it is in that, just like beyond our comprehension, that they're like, that's what's holy, you know. And it's so true that we, you know, humans try to, you know, make it all make sense in how we view the world, rather than like acknowledging that, you know, maybe some things are just beyond us, or there are things we just can't process.
Making meaning and explaining everything according to what we know or what we're able to conceive of, instead of saying we don't know, we can't know.
Right. You know? Well, and it's the classic thing with, like, you know, I off the top of my head, I can't think of a faith other than maybe animism that, like, doesn't try to personify deities, you know. It's like they're always like, you know, God created humans in his image, you know, sort of thing. Like, it's like, it's all like, oh, the divine looks like us, is like us in some way, rather than like, you know, the non-men being like, no, it's like, it's beyond, you know, it's like, it's the height of your ignorance and ego that you're, you know, trying to make it knowable and human and concrete.
Nice. I like that. I have one more. Everyone tells lies to dull the world's sharper, more complicated edges, some more pretty than others.
That's a great one.
That is a good one.
Oh, the Nilgicus is the king of Ishtarabin. It's mentioned a bunch of times in the appendices. I always remember he was a king of something, but yeah, wrong king.
Where is Ishtarabinth? That isn't the last refuge of the non-men, is it? What's the last refuge of the non-men?
It's one of the mansions, right? It's one of the surviving mansions.
Yeah, it's way north. It's very close to Ishual.
Yeah, it's quite north. Quite close, somewhat quite close to Sauglish and Golgotra, sort of. Not super close, but let's say north area.
Yeah.
What's just occurring to me is Ishwal is probably a mansion, right? It's like all underground. It's got these like labyrinths.
Maybe.
Like, it's described very similarly to how mansions are described.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the name of all the mansions, so, but they could have renamed it, right?
But it's like,
right.
You have a list of all the mansions, right? But yeah, it's around there.
Okay.
South of Golgotharoth.
Yeah.
Okay. So they may pass through it, the Great Ordeal. Interesting.
I think we're going to the right of it. Right, sort of going in the middle of those planes, but we don't know what their plan is, I guess. They're still a bit south for now.
They split up, too.
So, Athamian said that when the Skinny does confront him on whether they're going to make it with the company size they have, Athamian says we're going to be in the wake of the Great Ordeal. Mm-hmm. So, they're following something.
They're sort of like this.
Yeah, because
we're going kind of perpendicular, right?
Okay. I was thinking they're going to like follow up and like curve up into their path and follow, because it would be safer because they wiped out all the strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ordeal is going to have to skirt that Neliost Sea, right? There's no way
to
see any of that water. So kind of, yeah.
The smile from Steve. Oh, geez. What's in the sea? Oh no, what's in that area? Water. Oh shit.
just lots of friendly fairies and happy dwarves.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, nothing's going to happen around there, right?
Oompa Loompas, yeah.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, it's pretty easy getting to Golgotra, right?
lots of cotton candy in the circus.
Yeah.
I will admit, I've been shocked so far how easy it seemingly has been. I mean, I guess we haven't seen the, like, the big skirmishes they have with the Strong, but, like, it kind of feels like they've just been walking, you know? Clearly, that's not going to be the case forever.
We're just starting. We're just starting.
The base is beginning, but...
Yeah. I think it's interesting how, like, already, like, you know, it's such a mass of people that, like, there are these, like, logistical nightmares of, like, how do we keep this, how do we keep supplies coming through, and, like, yeah.
That's definitely a problem they're going to have to deal with eventually.
Yeah.
We've already mentioned it, right, that they need to forage, and even that is going to be really hard, right?
Yeah. Lots of people to feed.
It's going to be a challenge. But yeah, like, it's insane to say that, like the beginning of a series has already been, like, you know, more crazy than the last trilogy, and there's a lot to come. Like, we're not even started with the crazy shit.
No.
I don't know, there's some pretty crazy stuff in the last trilogy, you know? I mean, like, just whole sections of the Holy War.
Yeah.
Getting kicked off, true. You know, starving. I mean, going back to, like, having to deal with the supplies, like, disease ravaging them. When they have to go through the desert, that's one of the just, like, oh, brutal, brutal sections.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Lots to look forward to.
You could say that.
For us, not for the great audience so much.
Yeah.
Cool. Any other quotes or closing thoughts before we call it a night?
It's going to be fun.
Yes. And for anyone interested in Blood Meridian, we talked about it quite a bit today, but we're also going to be talking about it in the first week of May. If you'd like to chat with us about it, come check out the forum. And also, if you want to read this series with that, with that, let's do outros. Carl, do you want to go first?
Yeah. I am Carl. I guess I didn't even introduce myself at the beginning. So if you're a first-time listener, I'm a first-time reader. And you can find me ideally at the Patreon forum and not in the hellscape that is most social media. But if you want to find me on the socials, you can. I am Carl D. Albert in most places.
Justin?
Oh, okay. Reverse. Got it. Okay. I'm Justin. You can find me also on the Page Chewing Forum and occasionally on midnightmovietrain.com.
Nice.
And I'm Dan. You can find me on Page Chewing Forum. The Empire 17.
Yeah. Nice.
Dan always takes forever. Yeah, you can find me on pagejoin.com too. Come and say hello.
Yeah. And you can find me on the YouTube channel Reading by the Rainy Mountain, on the podcast Speculative Speculations, and of course on the Page Chewing Forum all the time. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you in a week with chapters 4 through 6 of The White Luck Warrior. Bye.